Jörg Widmann is also recognized as an internationally acclaimed clarinet soloist. So Tony and Jörg begin this final episode by talking about his playing career. They also get deeper into how he balances his schedule between composing, clarinet, and conducting. Then they get into a number of various subjects like national styles of composing, literature, and even performing on authentic period instruments. They wrap up their interview by going back to the beginning of their visit, combining curiosity with doubt, as they both can point to the future. But first, here's a quick message from our generous friends at Dorico.
Create music that moves with Dorico 5, the brand new version of the music notation and composition software from Steinberg. Packed with new features throughout the application, it's the perfect time to update from your current version or to try Dorico for the first time. You can start for free with Dorico SE or Dorico for iPad, which now allow projects with up to 8 players. Or step up to Dorico Elements, which now allows projects of unlimited size and features an expanded engrave mode. For professional use, choose Dorico Pro, which has many unique features you won't find in any other software. Visit www.steinberg.net/Dorico today and make more time for music.
Another aspect of your professional life, of your creative life, is playing the clarinet. And I heard you in Freiburg, and this shouldn't have been astounding to me, but it sort of was, or at least was surprising. You played the Mozart Clarinet Concerto. I forget which group you played it with.
Freiburg, I played it with the Helsinki Philharmonic Orchestra.
Oh, correct. Yes.
I think. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And what I thought was so great was typical of many classical concerti, for winds, the soloist, not every passage is a solo passage. And there were some passages where you had an accompaniment figure and you would almost turn, like Miles Davis a little bit, you would almost turn your back to the audience and you'd play with a second violin.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And I thought that was so great because it was a piece of, it made it into a piece of music and not just a clarinet concerto.
Oh, that's so beautiful, your observation.
And I thought that was terrific. So when you're approaching that as a complete musician, not as a clarinet player. And when you study a piece to play it, not that you can conduct it now, but to play it, does your experience as a composer and I guess now as a conductor influence the way you view the piece and the way you view your solo part?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, in the Mozart concerto, there are some passages together with the flute, for example. So I really turn completely, which turns the sound engineers mad sometimes, you know, because
yeah,
they say, we know you move, but try. But for me, even when there's a recording, live recording, you know, for me, especially a concerto like the Mozart concerto, it is chamber music. You know, when you look at it, there are many passages which goes between first, second violins. It's almost impossible for me to just play it into one direction. So that's very important for me. And the second part of your question, of course, implies that, of course, I don't leave my being a composer backstage when I go on stage as a clarinetist. So
right.
I can't. Of course, I'm completely a clarinetist when I'm on stage. But of course, I try to realize the whole score. We fail differently each time. It's a piece which, you know, you play all of your life, but you still discover things, I promise you. In every rehearsal, there are new contexts. Oh, this viola plays. Oh, yes, absolutely. I never was aware of that. It's so, so rich. And by the way, so full of dissonances too, that sometimes you really have to rehearse this dissonance because when you just play them and they just happen, they sound wrong. If you play them too consciously with Mozart, well, then it's kind of concept art. It's also nothing one should approach in Mozart, I think. So one should know about it and forget about it at the same time. And like a bird in the moment, fly. By the way, yes, fly from the flute to the second violins. And sometimes I really want to be a part of the ensemble sound. sometimes I'm enjoying so much, especially in Mozart concerto, to accompany the other instruments. It's equally important.
So, yeah, it's interesting that I think for brass players, for example, I think brass players make their phrasing decisions probably 95% based on melody and only maybe 5% based on harmony. At least for, not for a modern piece, but you know, for a classical or romantic piece. Do you think it's a little bit that way for woodwinds? I would think it's less that way for woodwinds, but I think you can make a lot of really important phrasing choices based on harmony rather than melody.
I mean, first of all, let me take the opportunity. I learned so much from you about trumpet and through the exams of the students. For example,
really?
The piece, yes, the piece by Benjamin Britten for three trumpets, right?
Yeah, beautiful piece.
It's a fantastic piece. It influenced me a lot, you know. I will not forget it. And they stand at three different places in the space.
Right.
And this, for example. So I really thoroughly believe that we can learn from each other so much. So when we mentioned this great American orchestra like Boston and Cleveland, what I heard there, you know, these four trumpets in my flute concerto, this brilliance and unity of their sound as four trumpets, oh, how sexy in a way. You understand what I mean? It's so sparkling and radiant sound. And also in Cleveland, I experienced that half an hour before the first rehearsal, the whole horn section was tuning out my quarter tones, my microtones. Where do you get that? So I'm grateful and I'm listening to brass players. For example, in horn, on a horn, the legato, there's something in between and I love it. Mm-hmm. With us on the clarinet, we take fingers off. So I try to artificially imitate a horn legato sometimes on the clarinet. So some of my clarinet colleagues say, don't make your life so difficult, just play the notes that I exaggerate. But so this is what I want to say first. You know, we can learn from each other. Why am I saying this? Because for me personally, I don't know if I speak as a woodwind player there, as a clarinetist, as a composer, as a human being. I don't know. I can just speak for myself. For me personally, everything is linked to harmony. I can't do differently than relate things to harmony. I even have the feeling that my melodies, when I compose, I cannot invent them independently from harmony. So for me personally, harmony means a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've asked several people, what should I ask Jörg in this interview? And they all say the same thing, surprisingly. And it's written out almost exactly the same, which is, how do you balance composing and teaching and conducting and everything that you do? It sounds to me like you, rather than trying to do everything all together in one day, you have intense periods of work on one thing. I don't know if I would say to the detriment of something else, but at least to the exclusion of something else. Do you think that would be correct?
I would answer it like that. Thank you for the question. And interesting is that different people ask the same question.
Yeah.
I would answer it like that. I promise you, I get energy from one thing for the other thing. So, for example, when I compose for a long period on a piece, which requires, I mean, loneliness sounds too romantic and exaggerated, but let's put it like that, it requires a lot of sitting, right? And staying at your table, you know. Can't imagine how happy I am when I'm amongst wonderful colleagues and instrumentalists and make music on stage together again. Even when, after a period like that, when an orchestra tunes, even, you know, when I have a transatlantic flight, when I fly to Asia and I missed my connecting flight and I'm tired, and when an orchestra even tunes, it gives me so much energy. And then when Mozart, Mendelssohn, modern music starts, any great music starts, I'm the happiest person in that moment. So I would answer it like that. I get energy from that. Then when I'm on tour and I've met many wonderful people, orchestras, believe me, as wonderful as it is, it's also wonderful to come back home and to close your door and to start your next piece or to study your next score for the next conducting project. So I'm so grateful that I'm allowed to have all these different aspects, and I get energy from each part for the other parts.
Yeah, that's great. Well, let me end by asking you some miscellaneous questions, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
Fasten your seatbelt here.
As you see, I'm especially honest with you. You know, in other interviews, when you asked me about this 5-week period, you saw I was just very honest, because I think, why should we artists, you know, try to pretend an image which we are not? It's all about honesty, and there are periods of as it says in the Bible so beautifully, there's the time of sleeping, there's the time for being awake, there's the time for peace, unfortunately for war. I don't know if it says literally, but you know this passage in the Bible. So there was a passage of, well, in the best sense, reflection. So the miscellaneous questions, I will try to answer them equally honestly.
Okay, well, it will be fun at least. So the first one is, if we go back in time, maybe 50 years or so, and you think of composition in America, America's famous composers, let's say Copland, Gershwin, had a very American sound. Shostakovich, Prokofiev had a very Russian sound. Debussy, Ravel, very French sound. Do you see that sort of difference in cultural identity with modern composers? For me, it seems like it's much more difficult to tell a modern American composer as compared to a modern European composer, whatever modern means these days.
I think that it's a very good question and very interesting question. And I think, you know, there are these stories, you know, when there were these modern music festivals and in Germany in the 60s, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, that all people were coming from different, from all over the world, you know, from South America, from Scandinavia and so on. And they would, I exaggerate now, and as you have seen, I admire this generation of composers, and especially Boulez, Stockhausen, so much. But when they would meet the young students in the trains going to Darmstadt and Donaueschingen, and then they would know, oh, you have to write like serial music. So that's the law, you know, write it like that. So there was a certain time where you could not distinguish anymore the language of a South American and of a Scandinavian composer, because the language of the time was forced to be limited a little bit, if I may say that critically. I personally love it when you hear where somebody is from, you know. And the older I get, I'm more aware of where I'm from, for example. As a young person, you don't care so much, maybe. You know, you live, you write. But I feel I was born in Munich, for example, and this whole atmosphere, musical atmosphere, music, and also the Bavarian folk music even, you know, the brass music, it had a huge impact for me. Maybe you know my piece, Du Bayerische Tänze. It's a pun between Dubai, because I was in Dubai, and Bayerisch, which is Bavarian. Du Bavarian dances. And so this had a huge influence for me, and I always loved it. But I have to tell you, you know, because you asked me when I went to Juilliard, some of the German music, I had to go to the States to properly learn about it. You know, this guy I mentioned, David Diamond, so Hindemith was at Yale, right? He was teaching at Yale. So I was studying, properly studying, in this class, his Pittsburgh Symphony by Hindemith. what a fantastic piece. To be honest, in Germany, I was not so aware how great this music is. So that's also interesting that we are so international now that we can learn so much there. Or somebody who has lessons with you in Freiburg gets a big deal of an American tradition as well, which I find wonderful. And I think with the composers, we talked about Boulez is very clearly a French composer. Ligeti is very Hungarian composer, right? You know, so yeah, to me, it remains important. Yeah.
Do you have to say no very often to conducting or clarinet or commissions possibilities because you're just overbooked or you have to really focus on one particular project? And is that difficult for you?
You mean if I can't accept?
Yes, right.
Unfortunately, and believe me, I suffer because there are many things I would love to do because I'm either musically interested in it or I like the person who is asking me so much. But there's limited time. Believe me, ask my management, my publishers, you know, when a young ensemble wants a piece from me and I feel the enthusiasm, but I can't because in the next 3 years, it's almost impossible to accept another commission. And it feels strange if already now on paper it says what I will do in 3 years. That feels strange sometimes. And believe me, I feel sorry when I have to, when I can't accept, you know, inquiries like that, but I have to do it sometimes.
Yeah. Do you have books that have really influenced your views on creativity or views on life, let's say? Favorite authors?
You mean literature, books?
Literature, yes. Yes, yes, correct.
Oh, a lot. For me, it's mainly poetry, you know. For me, in German language, Rilke is so important for me. I mean, it's a love of my youth. And a little bit later, Baudelaire. Many pieces of myself have to do with Baudelaire. My piano sonata, Le Fleur du Mal, for example. Rilke, I always had the dream to set to music his sonnets to Orpheus. A wonderful cycle of poems. But you know what the problem is, Tony? This poetry is music already. You know, one of the poems even starts with the word gong. You know, who are we? Should I hit a tam-tam? you know, I could maybe translate it in a way. And maybe one day I will do it. It's still a dream. But it's already music. So literature is so important for me. Then, of course, all kinds of arts. I even had, because we talked about America, the wonderful American artist James Terrell, who does these fantastic light installations in almost every famous museum in the world. We were already in contact and planned a project. It didn't happen in the end, but light, theater, this inspires me. Theater, I dream of a new way of music theater. Let's see what it will be. I have the impression in our times it should be something dystopian. I think we are living in, on one hand, Babylonian times. So my last opera was called Babylon. And at the same time, we're in almost dystopian times. You know, there's so much Orwell going on in daily politics, you know. Recently in German politics, and it doesn't matter if it's the left or the right in this case, you know, there was from the CDU, the conservative party, the Merkel party, former Merkel, the prime minister of a big county, of the biggest county in Germany, said, well, conservatism was never one of the roots of our party. You know, that would be like a social democrat would say, well, the social aspect was never important to the Social Democratic Party. So that's Orwell. War is peace. You know, freedom is slavery. That's so strange. Then the Green Party leader said, well, because we have our roots in the peace movement, therefore we have to deliver arms right away and we have to put a lot of money into the military. Well, say, if you are convinced, say it, but say, well, we changed our mind because of this and this. But they say, well, because that's the roots. So there is really something strange going on, you know, in all parts of politics. So for me, as an author and as somebody who writes dramas, that's as horrible as it is, it's wonderful. One should do something dystopian. I mean, daily politician speeches give you, you know, if one could solve the copyright question, you know, that's the best libretto you can get, you know. Worst in a way, but you know what I mean. So I've many ideas about that.
You could write a parody. So I just was thinking about this yesterday because I know you love poetry and you also love chamber music. Would you say poetry to novels is like chamber music to orchestral music, meaning that poetry is a more condensed version of saying something, as perhaps chamber music is? Do you think that would hold any credence for you?
Tony, I never thought about it, and it's so simple and so beautiful and so true. It's wonderful, wonderful.
Okay. I just said that yesterday, but I thought I'd throw it out and see what you thought
it's
about
wonderful.
It.
It's wonderful. Yeah.
Okay. Well, good. I'll think about that some more. You conduct, for example, I would assume I've heard you do the Mozart 41st Concerto. Do you have strong ideas about performing on authentic instruments and authentic phrasing versus contemporary instruments and phrasing?
To me, it's important to know about it and then to be free with it. So you mentioned the Jupiter Symphony.
Right.
With WDR Symphony Orchestra, who had a very long and intense relationship with. We did a lot of repertoire together. And in this recording, you might have realized that I have historic trumpets, but modern horns. So for some reason, that, although maybe, again, from both sides, there will be huge criticism, that's what I found, and with natural skin timpani. That's what I need for this symphony, for some reason. But it might happen that when we have our next conversation in 2 years' time, I might have changed my mind because I have more and different experience with it. Then especially also things like orchestra setup. Many people are really have, as you said beautifully, strong opinions about it. I like to experiment, and for some pieces, different, and so on. What serves each piece most? I think that's how I would put it. You know, even in other Mozart symphonies, I do it with modern trumpets, or in Beethoven anyway, in my interpretations, with the same orchestra. And Jupiter Symphony and Beethoven 7 is not that many years away from each other. And we did both symphonies really differently and with a different, you know, orchestration. Well, I think I have strong opinions about everything when it comes to music, but equally strong doubts. And the doubt is so necessary. You know, when we are too sure, or sometimes we think, oh, we have found something. That's my interpretation now. Then you touch the piece again 5 years later, and you hear your old recording, and you think, oh no, did I really do this? Honestly,
yeah,
I'm not
being
coquette about it. I'm honest, or in playing. When I played Weber Concerto once, I played it with Toronto Symphony Orchestra a lot and Peter Ungian, which was a great, great joy on a European tour. We rehearsed in Toronto, I think something like 5 weeks before it, because the dates did not work. And then we only met on stage in Europe, and it was wonderful. And it was a very inspired and wonderful performance. But at two or three places in my playing, not the orchestra playing, in my playing, I really thought, you know, like stupid things. Like before you go on, what you have been telling your students for 20 years, you do yourself. You avoid that. I'm doing it myself. Then I really think, why did I not hear it in that moment. So these things happen too, or more grave things, like more important things like interpretation. Not substantially, maybe, like something like Tempi, but even Tempi. Andantes, for me, feel should be faster today than 20 years ago. They were too close to adagios when I was younger, I feel. Today, I want to play an andante a little bit more fluent.
Yeah. A quick question about using, for example, for the Mozart, natural trumpets and modern horns. If you were playing that in a completely different hall, do you think there would be the possibility that you would ask for the opposite, that the horns would play natural horns and the trumpets would play
modern? I would be very, very interested. And you are mentioning something very important, which is different halls. And there are some performers which say that's, there are actually many people who seem to know that's Beethoven's tempo. I admire them for the great contact with him.
His life was that way, but I don't think so.
But of course, he writes metronome. I mean, it was discussed all over and over again. Are they too fast? Are they not too fast? In Beethoven 7, for example, for the conductors, it is difficult. You know, you have this kind of funeral march. So there's a certain heaviness about it. And you don't want the 16 notes later in the fugato to sound. You don't want a sewing machine there, right? So you need some pesante, some solemn feeling about it. At the same time, he writes allegretto. You know, Michael Gielen, who was in Freiburg, writes in his autobiography, and he conducted a lot in the States and in Europe, and he writes that he was criticized many times that he conducted the andante from Beethoven's seventh much too fast. And then he writes very beautifully, well, dear music friends, there is no andante in Beethoven's seventh symphony, only an allegretto. And that's a almost contradiction for us. I think he wants to remind us, don't get too solemn, too slow,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But if you actually do it, it's also tough. So it's not easy. So what I want to say, in one hall with a big reverb, you know, when you have a sound like that, we might play it in a different tempo. And I take it as an interesting idea to even switch it like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For Jupiter, I liked it in a way to do it like that. Yeah.
Well, just a few minutes ago, you talked about doubt and the many doubts that you would have about how you approach a piece and how you play and maybe even how you compose. And we started this conversation by talking about curiosity. And
yes.
I think that maybe the two are related, and that might be
True.
A good way to end this conversation. If you have something that you'd like to say, this has just been so enlightening and so much fun for me. I've got goosebumps right now talking to you.
This has been great.
For
me, Tony, I thank you for the invitation and for our conversation. You have seen that I also wanted to give, also your viewers a little insight in my life, because I like you, I believe in you, we have been knowing each other, and we have been, now we can say it, that we knew it always, we're wonderful colleagues. You know, it was an inspiration for me to be in the same school as you have been. And as I said to you in the exams of your students and of the brass department students, I learned so much. I learned repertoire. I got inspiration for my own music. And again, our conversation was inspiring for me. I'm happy to hear you enjoyed it too. And I think that's a wonderful link. Doubt and curiosity. And I think it's a wonderful thing to finish our talk with these two words, because they both go to the future, right?
Yes.
Because without doubt, when you have a doubt, you try to solve it. And you know this wonderful sentence, I never can quote it correctly, but it's Beckett, you know?
Failure? Yeah.
Yes.
That's wonderful, yeah.
Try again, and fail again, try again, fail better.
Yes, exactly.
And this I love, you know?
Yeah.
And in a literal sense, that's when we go on stage, let's fail better in a way. I mean it very seriously, you know, with all the experience. And you know, I said to an orchestra once when I did a mistake on tour, I said, so today I make different mistakes.
Yeah.
you know, in a way, but maybe another moment makes us speechless and breathless because it's a magic moment. And only with curiosity and doubt, the wonderful moments can be created and can be made possible. I strongly believe in that.